All right, good morning. Next and last case we've got this morning is docket number 77573, Mojica versus State. And counsel, you'll see that we're all spread out. We've got Justice Kadish in the Las Vegas courtroom and Justice Hardesty in his own private courtroom. And I'm here in the courtroom in Carson City, so we're a little spread out. Counsel, would you like to reserve a little time for rebuttal?
I would. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
All right, very good. Then if you'd like to begin, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, justices. I'm Deborah Westbrook from the Clark County Public Defender's Office on behalf of the appellant Martin Mojica. This appeal raises two important jury instruction issues that have not yet been addressed by this court. Whether a Gaxiola instruction is appropriate in a non-sexual assault case where the sole defense is voluntary intoxication, and whether a Mendoza instruction is mandatory when the acts alleged by the state to constitute coercion are the very same acts that constitute kidnapping. But before I address the jury instruction issues, I want to discuss Martin's kidnapping conviction and why, as a matter of law, that conviction must be vacated for insufficient evidence under Mendoza. Martin was convicted of both kidnapping and coercion based on a single course of conduct. He pushed his wife away from the front door of their apartment and told her, "You're not going anywhere." The actus reus of both crimes was identical, a push which caused the victim to move away from the front door and restrained her from leaving. In Mendoza, this court recognized that a defendant could not be convicted of both a kidnapping and a robbery that arose from the same course of conduct unless the state could prove the following: that the movement or restraint stood alone with independent significance from the act of the robbery, or that the movement or restraint created a risk of danger to the victim that substantially exceeded that necessarily present in the robbery, or that the movement or restraint was substantially in excess of what was necessary to commit the robbery. And when we apply Mendoza here, Martin's kidnapping conviction must be vacated because there was only one course of conduct involved in both acts, a single push that caused Martin's wife to move and restrained her from leaving the apartment. Now, I recognize that Mendoza was a robbery case, and the reason this court limited dual convictions for robbery and kidnapping is because robbery is a crime that inherently involves a degree of movement or restraint. But Mendoza is not limited to robbery cases. This court has applied Mendoza in sexual assault cases as well. And just today in Lofthouse versus State, this court recognized that the same dual conviction concerns that arise in sexual assault and robbery cases may also arise when the predicate offense is a crime against the person of a minor. That was in footnote 12. The plain language, if you look at the coercion statute, NRS 207-190, demonstrates that coercion is a crime against the person. The statute criminalizes using violence or inflicting injury upon the other person or threatening violence or injury. It criminalizes depriving the person of a tool, implement, or clothing, and attempting to intimidate the person by threats of force. In this case, we're asking the court to apply Mendoza to the crime of coercion because, just like robbery and sexual assault, movement or restraint are inherent in the crime of coercion. Again, looking at the plain language of the coercion statute, subsection 2A, the only way that this crime is elevated to a felony is if one of two conditions are met. There has to be either physical force or the immediate threat of physical force. Well, those same two conditions are present in the crime of robbery and sexual assault. Robbery is a taking by means of force or violence or fear of injury. And sexual assault involves subjecting or forcing a sexual penetration on the victim. Since the felony coercion statute requires either physical force, violence, or the immediate threat thereof to be applied to the victim's person, just like the robbery and sexual assault statutes, movement or restraint are inherent in the crime of felony coercion. Movement or restraint are also an integral part of the object of the crime of coercion. The mens rea for coercion requires the specific intent to compel another to do or abstain from doing an act which the other person has a right to do or abstain from doing. The object of coercion is to restrain the victim's free will and to force the victim to act in the way the defendant wants the victim to act. That means that movement or restraint are inherent in the mens rea of the crime. Movement or restraint was also inherent in the actus reus of the coercion, the specific form of coercion that was charged in this case. You look at subsection 1A of the coercion statute, it requires the defendant to use violence or inflict injury directly upon the victim or to threaten violence or injury. And that's what Martin was accused of doing in this case. Turning to Jury Instruction 22 in Volume 2 of the record at page 252, you can see that that was the state's theory of the case. That instruction states, any person who unlawfully uses violence or threatens violence or injury upon another person with the intent to compel that person to do or abstain from doing an act which that person has a right to do or abstain from doing is guilty of coercion. When a defendant uses violence or inflicts injury directly upon a victim, it necessarily will restrain that victim to some degree because the defendant is directly and physically interacting with the victim. It's the same thing that happens when you commit a robbery from the person by force or violence. And it's the same thing that happens when you commit a sexual assault through force or violence. That's why movement or restraint are inherent in the specific coercion charge at issue in this case. Because movement or restraint are inherent in the charge, Mendoza has to apply. When we apply Mendoza, the kidnapping conviction must be vacated as a matter of law.
And counsel, I just want to be clear that the record, when I dig further into it, will show that you requested the Mendoza instructions, correct?
So, Your Honor, we did not actually request a Mendoza instruction. This is a sufficiency of the evidence argument, which can be made on appeal for the first time. Counsel had actually raised a challenge after the trial to challenge the dual convictions, arguing that Mendoza did apply. Our position is that this is similar to the Ford versus State case, where in Ford versus State, this court recognized for the first time that in the pandering statute, there is a specific intent element. Nobody requested a specific intent instruction in that case, but the court interpreted the statute to require that element. And essentially what we're doing here is we're asking the court to apply Mendoza to this particular crime in the context of a sufficiency of the evidence challenge. And the court can do that as a matter of law. I believe the court's, it's a similar situation also to the Ibarra case, where the court determined what the proper or what the elements were of the offense of robbery from the person. And so the court would conduct a de novo review as to, what the statute requires to actually convict somebody. But when we move to the argument of whether a jury instruction should be given, the reason I've put that second in my argument is because I want to make clear that if this court finds that Mendoza applies, then as a matter of law, it would be plain error not to have given the Mendoza instruction. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
So I want to also discuss the fact I recognize there are some types of coercion that don't require physical contact between the defendant and the victim. And I want to explain why movement or restraint are still inherent in those cases. Those are the cases where there's only a threat of violence or the deprivation of a tool or you're attempting to intimidate, those other ways you can commit coercion. The reason movement or restraint are still inherent in these cases is because every felony coercion requires physical force or the immediate threat of physical force. And it's the same thing under Nevada's robbery statute. A defendant can commit a robbery without direct contact with the victim simply by threatening a victim. So let's say a defendant enters a store, points a gun at the clerk and says, "Freeze," and then grabs merchandise. Even if that defendant never touched the clerk, the defendant has still committed a robbery. It's not a robbery from the person, but it's still a robbery because it's a taking by means of force or violence or fear of injury from the clerk's presence. It would also arguably be a coercion under subsection 1A of the statute because the defendant has used a threat of violence or injury with a specific intent to prevent the clerk from interfering with the robbery. And under Nevada law, because there was a robbery, the defendant would be entitled to a Mendoza instruction if the state charged him with kidnapping during that same course of conduct. So that example shows how direct physical contact with the victim isn't required for there to be restraint. It's the element of the force or the threatened force that creates the restraint. And those elements are inherent in every felony coercion charge, which is why Mendoza must apply to the crime of coercion and why Martin's kidnapping conviction must be vacated. And as to the instructional error, just to reiterate, we believe it was plain error for the district court not to give a Mendoza instruction because that instruction would have told the jury the additional elements that they need to find before they can convict the defendant of both kidnapping and an underlying offense. So had the jury been properly instructed, the jury necessarily would have found that the act of kidnapping was incidental to the act of coercion, since both involved the exact same course of conduct, the push along with the statement, you're not going anywhere. And so we can say without question that that instructional error violated Martin's substantial rights and caused prejudice, just like in Ford versus State. I want to turn now to the Gaxiola issue. Over Martin's objection, the court gave a Gaxiola instruction that told the jury, the testimony of a victim alone, if believed beyond a reasonable doubt, is sufficient to sustain a verdict of guilty. But that instruction was not appropriate to give in a non-sexual assault case, and it was legally inaccurate in light of Martin's voluntary intoxication defense. Gaxiola recognized that sexual assault cases are unique, and that there was a historical imbalance between victim and accused in sexual assault prosecutions. And the purpose of the no corroboration instruction in such cases was to offset a historical practice of requiring scrutiny of sexual assault victims' testimony. That was not at issue in this case. The defense in this case was very different from the defense in Gaxiola, where you had a man who was claiming that he did not touch a seven-year-old child, and the seven-year-old child got up and testified that he had been raped and also that there had been lewdness. This is not a he said, she said case. Martin didn't dispute Crystal's version of events. He simply argued that he lacked the capacity to form specific intent because he had too much to drink. The no corroboration instruction in this case essentially told the jury, if you believe Crystal's testimony, you can convict Martin based on that evidence alone. But believing the alleged victim was not enough here because intoxication vitiated specific intent for all three charges, assault with a deadly weapon, coercion with a deadly weapon, and kidnapping. It was possible in this case to believe Crystal's version about what Martin physically did and to believe Martin's testimony that he didn't remember, that he didn't have the capacity because he drank too much. You could believe both of them 100%. And in that situation, acquittal would have been required. But the Gaxiola instruction that was given told the jury the opposite. In essence, the jurors were instructed that they could ignore Martin's affirmative defense as long as they believe Crystal. Because that misleading instruction impacted the jury's deliberation on all three charges, it was not harmless error.
And Ms. Westbrook, are you saying, did you just refer to voluntary intoxication as an affirmative defense?
Well, it's a defense in this case because he presented evidence that he was intoxicated, and therefore, once that defense, or once there is sufficient evidence presented to get the defense, then it becomes the state's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he had the capacity. And there were several jury instructions that were given in this case, and I don't have the
numbers. I've got number 30 in front of me.
I think there were three, and proffered type instructions that the defense offered that said if the state doesn't prove so that he had the specific intent beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must find him not guilty of coercion. And then there was one for each of the three instructions, each of the three charges.
Right. Okay. With that, I'll reserve
my time.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Rolls, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning.
Please proceed.
If it pleases the court, justices, defense counsel, I want to start off by discussing the Mendoza aspect of the coercion and the kidnapping, because I would point to Justice Kadish's opinion or question to Ms. Westbrook that it was never asked down below for Mendoza instruction for two reasons. And I think that's why it was never asked for two reasons, is because one is coercion is not an associated offense, kidnapping. And in general, in this particular case, the conduct that the state argued was separate and distinct from the conduct that was argued for the kidnapping conviction. So the reason why Mendoza instructions were never asked by defense counsel is because coercion is not an associated offense.
And I'm not so sure that's true, counsel. At Record on Appeal 5AA912, the state's closing is recounting for the jury that Mojica prevented Salazar from leaving. And as soon as he did that, he seized her, he detained her, he confined her, and she told us that she didn't want that to happen. So that conduct was both coercion and kidnapping.
And, Your Honor,
that's what you argued to the jury, right?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor, because I think if you read the entire closing argument as a whole, if you look at, what is it, page 909 of the brief, page 910, or of the brief of the record, page 910, page 911, the state clearly distinguishes between the two incidents of conduct. On 909, I state that the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he intended to keeping her from leaving his presence. That's in context of the coercion. Similar on 909 of the brief, I state we charged him by doing so by preventing her from leaving. I then say he uses violence, the push, to prevent her from doing something. And then on 910, it's clear what I'm discussing when I'm discussing coercion, when I'm discussing the lesser included offenses, because on 910 of the appendix, when I'm discussing the lesser included offense, I reference the fact that if you don't find that he doesn't use force or he doesn't use push when he prevents her from leaving, then it's just a misdemeanor coercion. So when, during my closing arguments, when I'm discussing both of those aspects at the same time, the preventing her from leaving and then the subsequent conduct of seizing her by telling her she's not going anywhere, the state submits to this court that what I'm doing here is I'm focusing my argument on the specific intent aspect of kidnapping here. Because this court's well aware that what I need to do to prove intent, or what the state, one, some of the things the state does to prove intent, is to rely on the circumstantial evidence of the conduct, the before, the after, the during. And so I think appellant sort of conflates my arguments with kidnapping and coercion, when in reality what I'm doing is highlighting aspects of the coercion to prove the intent of the kidnapping. And that's clear throughout my closing arguments. And even on page 938 of the appendix during the defense's closing arguments, they reference that fact. They reference what my coercion charge is by referencing that the coercion charge was her attempting to leave the front door. So even in the defense's closing arguments, they understand the distinction between what the state is trying to do. So I don't think the state did not intend to argue that coercion and kidnapping were the same conduct. But if this court finds that the state, or if this court finds that they were part of the same conduct, I don't believe that coercion is an associated offense of kidnapping, because I would submit to this court that what appellant is doing is they're conflating a restraint on a person's liberty and a restraint on physical and movement. So coercion is essentially preventing someone through the use of force or the threat of force, prevent them from doing something they have a right to do or not to do. And even in the appellant's argument about the robbery situation, they use the word freeze. So right there is the inherent seizure of the movement, or the inherent physical seizure of a person that this court has found to be inherent in robberies and sexual assaults. In coercions, there are a number of examples where you can have a coercion without having a restraint on movement and without having a physical inherent restraint. Take, for instance, a situation in which a victim is undergoing a domestic violence situation and they go to call the police and the defendant says, if you call the police, I'm going to punch you. In no way, shape, or form has that victim been physically restrained, and no way, shape, or form has her movement been restrained. What's been restrained and what coercion highlights is her liberty, her rights, her right to call the police. And in this particular case, it was her right to leave the front door. So there are situations in which coercion can occur, and a kidnapping is nowhere near that. So I don't think it's an associated offense, and in this particular case, it was not part of the same conduct. I think it's clear that it's separate and distinct from the kidnapping in general here. In addition, Your Honor, or Justices, this, to the best of the state's knowledge, is that there has never been a time when the court has addressed coercion in Mendoza, despite the fact that there are cases where coercion, kidnapping, and robbery were charged together and before this court. So I think that further highlights the fact that coercion is not an associated offense, because this court has been clear it has to be inherent. The restraint has to be inherent in the underlying offense. Situations in which you cannot have the offense without a kidnapping. You can clearly have a coercion without a kidnapping. And so I would submit to this court that it's not an associated offense, and in this particular situation in general, it wasn't the same conduct. Unless there are any other questions regarding the coercion, I'd like to turn the attention to the Gaxiola instruction, if it pleases the court. Appellant does highlight a few aspects of the Gaxiola reasoning regarding the history of sexual assault victims, but there is another aspect to the reasoning in Gaxiola that I think applies across the board, and that's when situations occur when there is no independent corroborating evidence of crimes. Crimes that occur at home, crimes that occur in secret, crimes that occur behind closed doors, when in all reality it's only going to be the perpetrator and the victim. And I would submit to this court that there's a perfect example of why Gaxiola, the reasoning that applies not only in domestic violence cases, as was argued in front of Judge Johnson, but in every case in general. For instance, if an individual is walking down the street at 2 o'clock in the morning, and another individual comes up to them and says, give me your money, and points a gun at them, the person, the victim, gives them the money, there's a robbery. 2 weeks later, that victim then runs into the defendant. She says, or he says, I know 100% that is the person who robbed me. The police do their investigation, and during the course of their investigation, they're unable to find a firearm, they're unable to find any of the property that was stolen, and they're unable to link it through video surveillance or any forensic evidence. However, the victim's testimony that I was robbed and that person robbed me may be sufficient to sustain a verdict of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, because that's the only evidence there is. The Gaxiola instruction suggests that testimony is evidence. That's all it does, and it recognizes the fact that there may be times that the victim's testimony alone may be sufficient if believed beyond a reasonable doubt.
So Mr. Rolls?
Yes, Your Honor.
This is Justice Kadish. Hi. What about the argument Ms. Westbrook makes that it, in this case, given the defense theory that voluntary intoxication negated the specific intent here of the actions, does that make the Gaxiola instruction misleading in the context of this case to the extent it implies to the jury, hey, if you believe her description of the events that happened, that's enough and you can convict, perhaps without considering what impact intoxication had here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I don't believe it limits the jury's consideration of her testimony regarding his state of mind. And if you read through the trial transcripts, the state made it very clear that his wife of 10 years, was one of the people who was in the best positions to determine just how intoxicated he was in the best positions to determine just how coherent he was, how he was able to formulate sentences, how he was able to conduct business throughout the time. So I don't believe that the Gaxiola instruction itself says, hey, you have to believe everything the victim says and ignore what the defense says, because the state still has the burden to proving that he was not intoxicated to the point where he would not be able to form the requisite specific intent. And so all I think that does is it highlights the fact that, yes, a victim's testimony alone may be sufficient if believed beyond a reasonable doubt, but even in this particular case, you have to believe the victim's testimony beyond a reasonable doubt that he wasn't voluntarily intoxicated or intoxicated to the point where he couldn't form a specific intent in combination with all the other evidence, because every single other instruction highlights other aspects of the case. There was the voluntary intoxication instruction. There's instructions regarding direct and circumstantial evidence. And the jury is not supposed to highlight just one specific instruction, but take them as a whole. So I don't believe that it limits the juror's ability or negates the juror's ability to determine that. What it does
is... The jury was given, I assume, this, and I'll obviously it's in the record, the standard instruction that tells them not to single out any single point or instruction and ignore the others, regard each in light of all the others, et cetera, standard instruction in every case. Was that given here?
I believe so, yes. It's a standard instruction that the state provides to the court in all trials, as this court's well aware. And so I don't believe that Gaxiola limits that discussion here, and especially because in their brief, the appellant makes issue with it giving in specific intent crimes. But this court has affirmed Gaxiola in specific intent crimes, because this court is well aware that lewdness with a child, which is a sexual abuse case, is a specific intent crime, and Gaxiola has been affirmed and is routinely given in those situations.
Counsel, I appreciate your arguments on this point. I wondered if you could comment. There appears to be a number of jurisdictions, though, that have backed away from this instruction. And in a number of states, Are you familiar with those authorities, and would you care to comment about the reasoning in those, where it appears to overemphasize the testimony of the victim over the other evidence and the testimony of the defendant if they testify?
The comment I would make, Your Honor, is that these arguments regarding Gaxiola have been raised several times before. These cases were rejected by Gaxiola. These same arguments have been rejected by this court on several times before. And excuse me if I can pull up the citations that we have. The defense relies heavily on an opinion, Ludi versus State, to overturn Gaxiola. Well, this court in 2012, in an unpublished decision, although not cited in our brief and unpublished, rejects that argument. They also rely on Gamage, a California case. As recently as 2018, in Thomas v. State, in an unpublished decision, this court rejected that argument. This court has routinely rejected all attacks on Gaxiola. These arguments are not new. These arguments are not something that has changed. I agree with appellant that the only real thing before this court as to whether or not Gaxiola is limited to sexual abuse scenarios. So I would rely on the principle of stare decisis when this is settled precedent by this court. This court has rejected every argument made by the appellant's bar regarding Gaxiola. I don't think there's anything new to suggest that, and I agree that the only thing is whether or not it's limited to sexual abuse cases, and I don't believe that's so because the same logic in Gaxiola applies in domestic violence cases even more so, because domestic violence cases are routinely situations in which they occur behind closed doors. They occur with only the victim and the perpetrator being witnesses to those events. So I think that logic applies to domestic violence cases as well. And Your Honor, with regards to the point that as I mentioned with Justice Kadish, the Gaxiola instruction, all it does is remind juries that testimony is sufficient and may sustain a verdict of guilty if believed beyond a reasonable doubt. Every trial attorney in Nevada knows that when you're selecting voir dire, and this is something that I did during my voir dire, that you are going to find individuals who do not think that testimony is real evidence. They think that testimony is not something that they can rely on. They always ask, well, what about, I need physical evidence, I need DNA, I need XYZ. And so this instruction reminds them that testimony is sufficient evidence and may sustain a verdict of guilty if believed beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you combine the Gaxiola instruction with every other instruction given that's routinely given in state courts, I think that I don't believe that Gaxiola instruction does anything to mislead jurors, because they are instructed several other times to take into consideration all the evidence. They're instructed on direct and circumstantial evidence. All this does is remind jurors about a correct statement of the law that a victim's testimony, if believed beyond a reasonable doubt, may sustain a verdict of guilty. And so that would be my response to that, in combination with the fact that this court has routinely affirmed Gaxiola over and over and over again. And the only question before this court is to whether or not Gaxiola is limited to sexual abuse cases. Unless there are any other questions, I would submit this to your discretion. I see that my time is up.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Westbrook. You've got a few minutes remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start with Justice Hardesty's question about, you know, whether we should possibly reconsider Gaxiola because it overemphasizes the testimony of the victim. And I think this case, and just because the court has affirmed it on numerous occasions, this case gives the court an opportunity to see how dangerous the Gaxiola instruction can be in this situation. It gives us an opportunity to reconsider. This case shows why the instruction essentially puts the thumb of the court on the scales, telling the jury that the victim's testimony is entitled to conclusive weight, effectively, when you have a question of specific intent. Now, counsel mentioned that Gaxiola involved sexual, the issue of lewdness, and that lewdness is a specific intent crime. But as we pointed out in our brief, lewdness, the intent for lewdness is obvious from the act itself. It's a different type of specific intent crime. In addition, Gaxiola was distinguishable because in that case it was a he said case where the defendant denied that anything had happened. So you had two competing versions of events. And that may often be the case in domestic violence situations, but this was not such a case. This was a case where the defendant acknowledged that he probably did all of the things she accused him of doing, but he just didn't remember. He didn't have the capacity to form the specific intent that was necessary in this case. Counsel mentioned the
wrong. Ms. Westbrook, you don't think that the multiple instructions given describing voluntary intoxication made it pretty clear to the jury that they needed to consider that argument?
Well, essentially what the jury was told was that they could consider her testimony on that subject alone. And she's not in a position where she can get into his head on his capacity. She wasn't, you know, she could talk about the things that he did physically, but she can't, it would be highly speculative for her to be testifying that he had the mental capacity in order to complete the crimes. So we would ask that the court reverse. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Colleagues, do you have any additional question for either counsel?
Not for me, thanks.
No, thanks to both counsel for their arguments.
Yes, thank you for the briefs as well, and this matter will stand submitted.
You don't look like David Westbrook.
I'm sorry.
Oh, is that what it says?
What was that, Justice Kiddish? Missed it.
Oh, I was noting that Ms. Westbrook does not look like David Westbrook, which is the name on the screen.
And that didn't show up for me, otherwise I would have changed it.
I just noticed that, too.
It's fine. We know who you are.
Very good. Matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until the next call.